When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Ugly Things Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Stacks, the editor and publisher of Ugly Things Magazine. The misunderstood had a dream, and nothing was going to stop them. In the summer of 1966, they scraped together what little money they had and hauled themselves and their gear across the world, from California to London, to find more receptive ears for their music. That music was special, powerful, innovative, unique. John Peel, then working as a DJ in San Bernardino, saw them for the first time at a local shopping center. When the Misunderstood started playing, he later wrote, "I couldn't believe what I was hearing. They were the best group I have ever heard or seen, bar none." Over in England, they elevated their music to an even higher plane. People paid attention. Annie Nightingale heard in them a glimmer of progress. Like it or not, she wrote in the Daily Sketch, "The Misunderstood may represent the pop music of the future." Back in California, Peel went even further, hailing them as prophets of a new order, harbingers of a brilliant, soft, and alive dawn for mankind. On December 9th, 1966, Fontana released their stunning UK debut single, "I Can Take You to the Sun." The Misunderstood's dream was becoming reality. By the first week of January, the dream was over. When Cherry Red released their first compilation of the Misunderstood's music in 1982, they titled it "Before the Dream Faded." But the dream didn't fade. The dream was crushed, swiftly and unmercifully. It's an amazing story, one I told in some detail in issues 20 through 23 of Ugly Things. Now we're going to revisit it for the podcast with my guest, Rick Brown, the band's lead singer, who talked to me from his home in Thailand. Part one of the story begins in the Southern California city of Riverside, where the band first got together while most of them were still in high school. Riverside lies about 60 miles east of Los Angeles in a region known as the Inland Empire. Sit back and enjoy our conversation. So the story of the Misunderstood kind of begins when you were in high school and you and your family moved to Riverside and you met Greg Treadway. So tell me about that.
Well, when I moved to Riverside, you know, I started high school in Riverside, and the first guy I kind of became friends with, besides some guy that lived around where I did, was Greg. In high school, I somehow met Greg and Rod Piazza, and we became friends, and we were into surfing. Everybody was into surfing. Rather, the surfing scene was pretty small in Riverside, but we were it. And we were going to the beach all the time, and there was no talk about the band or anything. I mean, I could see that Rod Piazza had this, there was a twinkle in his eye about music, you know, because I saw him one time at his house where, you know, I'm standing in the kitchen and he slides in from the side in the hallway, just like Tom Cruise, I swear to God, from Risky Business, you know, with his socks on and does, I swear to God, this is, so how many years before Risky Business? This is 1961 or something. He comes in and he does, and he's got some song playing. It's like Conway Twitty or something. And I'm like, man, this guy is positively going to be a performer, you know? Anyway, Greg and I didn't get the band going until years later, you know? Seems like that's why I want to talk to Greg about surfing a bit. But anyway, we got the band going.
You guys are landlocked in Riverside. I mean, you're an hour from the coast. So you would drive to Encinitas and surf at Swami's. What was Swami's like back when you started surfing there? This must have been like 63, 64, something like that.
But when we first started surfing, we used to go to a place called Killer Dana, Dana Point. And Dana Point used to be a really good surf spot. They used to have Doheny and the and Killer Dana. This is before they built the breakwater and built the harbor, you know. And when they built the breakwater and the harbor, that's when we started going further south. And we came across Swamis. And it was like, I mean, Swamis? There's this temple on the cliff overlooking this outrageous surf spot. And it had no, it didn't even have a stairway to the beach. I mean, there's a stairway to the beach for as long as people can remember now. But with, at this time, there was no stairway to the beach. You had to go behind the SRF and down this goat trail on the hill, on the cliff behind, and get to the beach carrying your board. And so, you know, we became friends with those guys. But, you know, it was kind of after getting the surfing going, then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you know, Greg's telling me that he's getting this band together, or he got this band together. I didn't even know it. And I swear to God, I didn't know there was anything going on with music, you know? I had never heard the Yardbirds at this point.
Yeah, this is pretty early. And I guess, you know, before you came along, Greg had this band with Rick Moe on drums and George Phelps on guitar, no bass. Right. A surf group called the Blue Notes. And they, I guess they had blue shoes and blue suits and dyed their hair blue for some of their shows.
Right.
But you didn't know about that. So.
No, I didn't know. They told me, hey, man, we got this band. Come and see if you can sing, you know? So I came and I think we did like a Righteous Brothers song or Animals or something. Or, you know, it was like before the Kinks for anything. It was the Righteous Brothers were first songs we were doing, you know? I swear to God. And, it was so early, I had to use a music table, you know, one of those music sheet table stands, you know?
Yeah.
With the lyrics. I mean, that was how early it was. So then we started hearing, you know, them and the Animals. The Animals in particular were really influential. And I started, that, at least on my singing, the Animals were really influential. The whole British scene was influential. Because the British scene had a kind of a materials thing to it, you know, and the Western scene had kind of a country thing to it. You know what I mean? That was kind of the thing that separated even psychedelic music. Like the London psychedelic was really metallic and really, you know, factory, you know, and American psychedelic was kind of country and it had that swing to it, that country swing.
Right. Yeah. Cause it came out of folk music. There was a lot of finger picking.
Yeah. The British thing came out of blues, which the Americans seemed to not even know about, you know, until the British came along. Really? It's like the Americans didn't even, oh, really? Got this blues music? Look at the Rolling Stones, this new sound.
So when you joined at that point, you were called for a while Treadway and Company. So Greg was very much still the leader of the band at that point. Yeah.
He's the only guy who had wheels. He had a blue van. It was a panel van. Didn't have any windows on the sides. It was a blue panel van.
And then the next thing, I guess, you needed a bass player. So you found Steve Whiting. So tell me about Steve and how did he change the band?
I can't remember how we found Steve. Maybe somebody told us about him or something. I swear I can't remember how he joined. You know, it was like, you know, we needed a bass player and he was this big brooding guy that seemed kind of older than us. And he seemed a lot older than us, really, at the time.
Yeah, he was already out of high school. I think he graduated a year before you guys. So that probably seemed like a... And I think he had his own place, you know, so he was like a grown-up.
Well, he was more serious. You know, he was kind of a mature, you know, he wasn't so playful as we were, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know about his background. I mean, he wasn't so playful as us, you know. Which is good, you know, for a bass player to be heavy duty, you know. And he was kind of a tough guy, you know. I mean, he seemed like, you know, if you're going to fight somebody in the band, you wouldn't want to fight him, you know. That's kind of the way it was.
He added a lot, right?
Oh man, it's like, you know, I couldn't believe we had no bass before. It's like without a bass, how are you going to have a bottom end, you know?
Yeah, right. Especially if you're going to be playing, you know, Animals and them and stuff like that.
Right. This is before we played blues. This is just the English sound. Kinks. The Kinks, man. They were so fun to play. Live, they were... I remember Gloria was the funnest song, the unbelievably fun song. It was a time when George Phelps was in the band and Greg. Playing, you know, Gloria and things like that was just fantastic. People loved it, you know?
Right. Now, you guys didn't do any Beatles stuff at all. You weren't...
No Beatles. Somehow the Beatles weren't connected to the blues or something. It wasn't even that so much as they weren't. You know, the truth is they weren't. And we didn't know that. But it's just the sound of the animals was blues-based, even though we didn't know that. It had that feel to it. And the British and the Beatles was pop-based, and we didn't know that per se, but we felt it, you know? That's why we...
Yeah. What about Rolling Stones? Like, was that an influence too?
Yeah, but it was kind of like they really didn't really fit in anywhere. I mean, that's the way we felt. Like, the Beatles were too square, and all these other bands were cool, and the Stones were kind of not cool or square. They weren't either one. It was kind of like they were in a category by themselves, kind of loose. They were very loose, you know? Like, I never heard nobody ever thought of the Rolling Stones in terms of a good lead guitar player. Nobody ever thought of that, you know? Like a standout lead guitar player, and they're going to have... They were just like, you know, a rhythm band kind of, you know?
So your bands were Kinks, Animals, them, and Yardbirds, right?
Right. Well, the Yardbirds later. But that was the best change, the Yardbirds. That was when Glenn got in. When Glenn got in, we started playing the Yardbirds.
So at this point, Steve joins and you change the name of the band to not the Misunderstood, but the Misunderstoods, plural.
It was that lady's idea. You know, the story from the book, how we pretended to be British just for a lark and got a couple gigs. And some lady found out about it who was in the music business. And when she found out that we weren't British and people thought we were, I mean, it was even in the paper. You know, then she said we could be called the Misunderstood, and so the whole thing was a joke. You know, and saying we're misunderstood is the best way to get out of it.
As I recall in the newspaper, you guys were just sort of talking in British accents to sort of impress some girls.
Yeah,
that's
it. Basically. I was on stage, you know, and talking in a phony British accent. And some people in the audience would even say, no, you're not. But I mean, everybody was mostly people were believing it, you know? Even when somebody would yell something like that, people would continue believing it. And the papers even wrote about it. A British band in Riverside. I mean, yeah, right.
But all your high school friends must have known this is bullshit. No,
we didn't even play at our high school. We played at a place in Redlands or someplace. We played at a place outside Riverside. Honestly, there was some place outside Riverside. Glenn would know, or rather, Greg would know. We played at some clubs outside Riverside, and it didn't happen in Riverside.
So you're like 5 miles away, then you...
Yeah, 5 miles away is like another country, you know?
Yeah, now we're British. In Redlands, we're British. In Riverside, we're from Riverside.
No, if you've got the balls to get up there in front of a bunch of people and say that, then there's a lot of people that are going to believe it.
Yeah, right.
Just because you got the balls to do it in the first place, you know?
Well, that sort of defined the Misunderstood. They were always just pushing it, taking chances. And you were doing things other local bands weren't doing.
Well, I thought it was so funny that we were pretending to be a British band and we ended up in Britain.
yeah. That was kind of foreshadowing that.
Right.
And also, this time, you started to write songs. The band as a whole started. You figured you needed original material. Was that just because there wasn't enough songs out there?
Right at the beginning, we started writing songs. You know, Greg wrote some songs. And I don't know who wrote Why, you know, our environmental song. I, honest to God, I remember that song, and it's recorded. But I, honest to God, can't remember. I think I wrote the lyrics, but I don't remember. And nobody can even tell me. When did we write that song? You know, but it was in the beginning, for sure.
Yeah, one of the first things, yeah.
Yeah, this is before, you know, when we were starting to play. This is before the Kinks, even. This was kind of like, you know, in the very beginning when we were listening to, I guess, Dave Clark Five and all those kind of bands, and we were trying to make a British sound. And we wrote some original stuff. And then after that, we kind of stopped doing that, and we started playing some British sounds, which people hadn't really heard. We started doing Kinks, and we started doing Them, and started doing British sound. We just kind of stopped writing original stuff. And the very earliest stuff was the original stuff. And then we did, and then we didn't really record all that Kink stuff. And then when we didn't really record much until Glenn got in the band.
Well, yeah, you did these demos in the summer, starting in the summer of 65. You went into that studio, William Losey Sound Company, and you were doing She Got Me and Crying Over Love and I Cried My Eyes Out and all those songs. You know, what do you remember about, you know, making your first recordings? What do you remember about this little recording studio?
Yeah, I remember, I look at a picture of it, and I see, yeah, that was it. You know, it was kind of, it was the first experience of being in a recording studio, and it was pretty easy, really. You know, you just, I mean, it always sounds 10 times better in a recording studio, 10 times better than it is.
I don't think that's true of all bands, but yeah, I guess with you guys, you took to it.
And I was thinking that I Unseen was written in the UK, but it was obviously recorded in the US, before even Glenn was in the band, you know?
Let's talk about that. I wanted to talk about that. You recorded that, I think, either December 65 or January 66. I mean, this song, you know, is very important, I think, to the Misunderstood story. And for a little background, you know, the song's lyrics, as you know, of course, you sang it, they're from the point of view of a seven-year-old child killed, you know, in the atomic blast Hiroshima. And that's from a poem by Nazim Hikmet. But you found a version on a Pete Seeger album, right? You found...
Right.
Tell us how you found the song and how you went about turning that, because Seeger called it I Come and Stand at Every Door.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were trying to do something kind of Yardbird. It was kind of like the Yardbirds. I think at the time the Yardbirds had done that song, that Gregorian chant where they would stop and then have that thing, you know?
Yeah, it's Still I'm Sad.
And I think that was influenced that song, this our version. But it was Steve who came out of nowhere with a guitar and invented that riff. Steve Whiting, the bass player, with a guitar. Listen to this and da 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 da. Okay, and we started doing it. Now, this is before Glenn was in the band, I guess. You know,
it is, yeah. And also, you know, the Byrds did the same thing with that song. They called it "I Come and Stand at Every Door," but you did this like, I think 4 or 5 months before the Byrds, you weren't even aware of the Byrds version, you know.
And you know, the one we did in UK years or later with Tony is the same version, really, you know. It's the same version as we did.
It's the same lick, but it's just heavier.
But I mean, even the arrangement is the same. You know, we did it more detailed, but it's the same arrangement and everything.
It's a fabulous thing, and it showed that already you had some vision of something different. And also that you were... you know, wanting to do a song that had a serious message. You know, I mean, you don't get more serious than a song about a child dying in an atomic blast. I mean, that's fucking serious shit.
Yeah, it's even more serious when they come back to life and start telling you about it.
Yeah. Then you're getting into the next stage. Yeah, that was... Anyway, that was something. And it showed the band was special. But and then not long after that, January.
Well, it also showed that Steve Whiting came up with a really good riff, because positively Steve Whiting wrote that on an acoustic guitar, you know.
Yeah,
that's where it came from. He came and showed me that riff. I thought it was in England, but instead, but I for sure I remember him coming and showing me this riff.
And then I think Rick Moe and Greg actually constructed a 12-string acoustic guitar to play it on. By taking a 6-string guitar and like adding extra machine heads to it and building it, because you couldn't afford to buy one. And so that's what you hear on that demo, which I love that version.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, the next thing that happens, you know, right around that same time, January 66, George Phelps decided to leave the band? You know, tell me a little bit about George. You know, what was he like as a personality, and why did he decide to leave?
Well, he was a quiet kind of guy, and honest to God, I don't know why, you know, because all of a sudden he's just telling us he's leaving. He was always quiet and soft-spoken and never got excited, and I swear to God, if he had any problems going on in his head, he wasn't telling us about it, you know? Just one day he said, hey, guys, I'm leaving. I'm going to quit, you know, and he wasn't pissed off or nothing had happened. It was just the weirdest thing, you know? Honestly, I don't remember anything happening that he became pissed off or anything like that, you know? Just one day, he just gave us the surprise, you know? But like when Greg had to quit, because it was because he was getting drafted and all this stuff, and he had to figure out what to do, you know, which I don't even, you know, which of course he had to do something. But this wasn't we knew about something that there was a problem. It was just, I don't remember anything being the reason for it, you know?
Yeah, I think he just, you know, he got out of high school and he was going to get a job or something.
There was something going on in his life that we didn't know about, and we never knew about what he was doing, because he never talked about it, what he was doing. He was very quiet, you know, the whole time. He would smile and laugh and stuff, but he never would talk about himself, you know?
So when George left, that's when you got Glenn. So let's talk about Glenn. You know, how, you know, I know you first saw him playing with his band, The Answers, when you were, this was the Christmas, but a few weeks before George left, and they were on the same bill as you, and you saw Glenn playing. Tell us about that night and the first time you saw Glenn playing.
Well, I remember being with Steve and seeing Glenn. I didn't know we played with him or whatever, but I remember watching him with Steve and we knew that we were going to lose, what's his name? We knew we were going to lose George. And we were both like, God, man, this guy's outrageous. You know, I mean, that's like, he wasn't even playing through a fuzz box yet, you know?
Yeah, but the fact that he was playing a pedal steel rather than a conventional guitar, but he wasn't playing like country licks at all.
He was playing rock and roll. And we were like, God, man. And then, you know, and not only that, but his hair was so long that it was just like, this guy must have been in business for 20 years already, you know? I mean, he had hair like you have, you know. I mean, that was like really crazy for those days.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And we were right out of high school, man. You couldn't have your hair that long. You couldn't have it even a little bit long. And he had like full on as long as yours, you know. You saw a picture, and that was like God Almighty, man. This guy looks like a total rock star, because that was like nobody had hair, like, even in the rock scene in England, hardly people had hair that long, you know. At that point.
Yeah, he looked really different. And then
look at the Kings, man. The Kings didn't have long hair like that. I mean, he had long hair like you have, you know. That was really special, man. You couldn't find anybody who had that many years to grow their hair, you know, in our age group. You know what I mean?
So you knew this guy was, you know, he could be something special for your band.
He looked like a star, and he absolutely played like a star. And he upped our game, you know, just by being there, you know.
So I guess you got his number that night and you gave him a call. And then, you know, there's a story of, you know, I guess it was sort of an audition, but he came over to where you were practicing at Frank Casares's house.
I just remember he came over with a couple of friends, you know, they were like helping him with his equipment or something. You know, it's like they were super nice guys. It was like, I didn't know there was a problem, you know, or he was afraid. I didn't know he had ever had a problem before. But he came up with a couple of nice guys and played, you know, and it was like right away, wow, heck yeah, man.
yeah, Glenn, I guess he brought a little backup because he said, you know, he'd got hassled in the past because people didn't like the idea of the steel guitar or maybe they just thought he was weird. He was a little insecure.
Well, he had really long hair for those days. I mean, that was like, you know, it was scary going out with him sometimes. And we had problems going out with him, you know, as the band, you know, and we'd go to a store and we'd get in trouble, you know, because of his hair, you know?
Right. Yeah. You were telling me the other day, and Rick Moe was saying too, about how you guys they refused to serve you in a supermarket because the way you look, they threw you out of the store.
Yeah, and then came out, and then wanted to fight, and came out with a bunch of guys. And they had all put on army shirts and had like weapons and stuff, and not guns, but I mean they had like clubs and stuff. And we ran for it. You know?
Wow.
Went and told John Peel. He was either there, or we went and told him, and then he told him, got it on the radio and said it. And then Rick Moe's now telling me the story, or telling us the story about how the Hell's Angels got involved and did something. I'm like, man, whew. Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, according to Rick Moe, who's not prone to exaggeration, you guys told some of your biker friends about what happened to you at the store, and the next night they went out and set the store on fire.
Well, I remember telling John Peel. I don't know who else told anybody else. I didn't know we had biker friends, but John Peel got on the radio and talked about it, and Rick probably knew some people that I didn't know. And I don't remember any store being set on fire. I hope not.
Yeah, hopefully there's a statute of limitations on that.
But yeah, no.
So,
but that just shows you that was, you know, we all had a little bit of hair, but I mean, Glenn had the long hair. You know, he was the only guy that had hair like you have, which is right down to your shoulders, and that really set those people off. They didn't like that he had that kind of hair. You know.
Yeah, it was. You know, it's. It's not Los Angeles, you know. Riverside's a little bit of a hick town, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, big redneck kind of community there, and
yeah,
you know, walking around like looking like Glenn looked in early 1966 and late 1965.
That was the first time in my life I had ever lived in a town where there was really kind of danger, you know. Like when I was in high school, when I was in junior high school, I never really felt much danger. And, you know, previously I never felt much. But when I got to Riverside, man, you know, there was like everybody wanted to fight. Maybe that's just high school, you know, but there was like people wanted to fight, you know, people wanted to fight. They wanted to fight the surfers. We didn't want to fight anybody. You know, there's no fun. That's not fun.
Right. You just wanted to surf. So, you know, let's talk about how Glenn changed the sound. So, you know, what was he doing, you know, other than the fact that he's playing a different instrument, an unconventional instrument for rock and roll, what was he doing with that instrument when he first joined the band?
Well, when he first joined the band, he was just playing lead, you know, and, you know, it was just effortless for him. You know, it was like, God, give me something hard to do, you know. He was just playing lead. And then we started kind of getting into blues right off the bat. And we started playing blues, and it was like effortless. You know, all these blues songs we were starting to pick up.
Right.
Shake Your Money Maker and all these things. We started playing that stuff, blues stuff. We weren't writing any original stuff at that point. None, you know?
Yeah, you seem like during that period you discovered like Butterfield, you know?
And there was only a few bands that we really did some of their covers. Like we did a lot of I'm Not Talking, but we didn't try to do hardly any other Yardbirds stuff. I don't think it's very easy to do any Yardbirds covers. Like, I don't think anybody can do Shapes of Things. Even the Yardbirds can't do it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have you heard them try to play that live? It just doesn't work. You know, I mean, that's a magical recording.
Yeah,
Shapes of Things.
And also you started experimenting with some lights, like some primitive kind of...
Glenn invented this stuff. He was the one who put his steel guitar through a volume pedal, you know, and was able to make these big chords that sounded like an orchestra. He was the one who put it through a fuzz box. He was the one who came up with this solder the light bulb and put it on a guitar jack and plug it into the extension amp output, and there you go, you know. I couldn't believe how easy it was. You know, we had this plan in England to make a big version of it.
Right. So, yeah, it's just a brake light from a car that he'd sold it.
It wasn't even a car. It was a motorcycle light bulb, just a white light motorcycle light bulb, soldered onto a guitar jack and plugged into the extension amp. Turned off the lights. He says, watch this. And he started playing, and we thought his amp was on fire. And it was that thing was just glowing exactly what he played, and literally in terms of intensity, how loud he played, in terms of what he played that would move. And It was brilliant. It was, and I can't believe nobody ever did it to this day. You know, I even tell people, well, I can't believe you, nobody's done this.
Yeah, and this is early 66. I mean, this is before everybody had
this. This is what we did in the Hi-Ho Club. This is what we did in that gig that John Peel saw. This is what we did in London, you know. It was only when Glenn was there we were doing this stuff.
Right.
When Greg was there. I say when Greg was there we were doing it. We were playing all the same stuff as Riverside.
Well, yeah, we've mentioned John Peel a couple of times. So let's talk about that because that's the next thing that happened. Back then, he was John Ravenscroft, and he was a DJ on one of the two local radio stations, K-Man.
Yeah.
And he saw you guys playing, I think it was at a shopping mall, like a Battle of the Bands thing. You know, what is your recollection of that day?
Yeah. It was in the open, you know, in the middle of a mall with no roof, you know, just in the center of a mall. We just play. It was our turn to play. We just got up on this platform and started playing. And we didn't really even know he was watching us. And I didn't know who he was. I mean, I heard knew him from the radio, but I didn't know that was him or something like that. He came up and introduced himself. And we were like, cool, you know.
He talked about it later, and he said it was the greatest band he'd seen up to that point, bar none. You know, and you know, he called it like his you know, St. Paul on the road to Damascus. You know, experience, you know, because yeah. He couldn't believe what you guys were doing, and especially Glenn with his steel guitar. You guys didn't sound like any other band.
Yeah.
He picked up on that right away. I mean, he was a real man of taste, right? He was a connoisseur.
No, he was a visionary. You know, he's like that. But I remember the first time I saw Glenn play, thinking, oh man, that's limitless. You know, and I didn't even know what you could do on a steel guitar, but I, you know, and just watching him play before he even joined the band, Steve and I are going, oh man, that's like ridiculous, you know? That's like so outrageous. I always liked that slide. When you hear a guitar player do a slide sound, you know, it was just, that was like the easiest thing in the world for Glenn.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
These huge chords and take the volume on and off and do stuff like that. Which is what he got into in UK, but we were in America. He was able to do all these weird screaming sounds, and we did that a lot live. We didn't do it so much in that recording from Gold Star. I'm not talking, but we did a long times thing when we would leave the stage and play around, and you know, Glenn would hold up his guitar, and Rick Moe would. You know, attack him with his drumsticks, and he would hold the guitar up and it would be beating on the strings. And I mean, we'd do a crazy stuff, you know, that, you know, after we got started getting back on the stage, you'd start doing crazy stuff like that. So you couldn't get that in the studio. That was like pretty noisy.
That's what I got to see. You're so big a loser, and I'm so a loser. Please buy that antenna, and I feel better. That's one thing I can do without.
So that day, John saw you. Obviously, he came up and talked to you, and you became friends. Talk about that. How did that relationship develop?
Well, he brought us over to his house, and we met his wife, who was this blonde, Shirley, and... he started staying in touch with us, and he started helping us get gigs. And we got a couple of Battles of the Bands that we won, you know. And we had one Battle of the Bands. Rod was not in this, but I remember the Northside Moss and Southside Blues Band, and a bunch of guys were there. And we had the sponsorship from this music company, Lears, where they had these Vox amps, these big Vox amps, this before Marshalls.
Right, the big Super Beetle amps, yeah.
Yeah, so they gave us these Vox amps for this thing, and we didn't before we even played that we won, you know, just being up there with all those Vox amps, we looked so cool. I wish there was a picture of it. And then when Glenn started playing, it's like, oh man, everybody can just pack it up. But we were playing, you know, Yardbirds and everything in those days, you know. You know, Glenn was saying years ago that those things were rigged, and I remember thinking they had applause meters, you know. like at the end of everybody playing, they would say, okay, who likes this? Who likes this? And people would, and the volume of the applause would determine who got the winning. So I don't know how you would rig that, you know? Because you could see the meter on the stage. You know, people would applaud. You could see it go up to who got the highest, you know?
Yeah, right, yeah.
And you could hear it also. That's how we won those things. That's how we won.
So do you remember what records John Peel turned you on to back then that were having an influence on you?
I really can't.
I mean, I think it was Glenn that said, you know, that, you know, that he was playing like, you know, Ravi Shankar and stuff like that.
Yeah, but I can't remember any particular things. I just remember him encouraging us to make music. But, you know, yeah, he was playing, you know, like, you know, it was Glenn and those guys that were making the music. So they were being influenced differently than I was. I was like into the lyrics and the singer, you know. I was telling Jiva last night, I was telling Jiva, so funny. In the old days, you know, even after being in the band for years, I'd have to ask the guys what key the song was in, you know, or which harmonica I would use. And it was funny, you know, because it was like, you know, I would refuse to memorize this stuff just for the hell of it, you know. And it's funny, you know, because even after you're a professional, you have to say, hey, man, what key is this in, you know? Or use an E harp. Okay, yeah, cool. The guys didn't even mind because it was so ridiculous.
Yeah. So another thing John Peel did for you was he got you show in L.A. at Pandora's Box on the Sunset Strip.
Right.
Tell me about that show.
Well, that was one of the best ever because nobody knew who we were. And what we did that night was just blow people's brains. I mean, I remember getting off the stage and going with him in the back behind the crowd and looking at our stage, and there's only Mo up there, and all these lights are blinking from our amps and this feedback in tremolo. And I remember going, I just couldn't believe how everybody's mouths were hanging open. And nobody was even looking that I was there, you know?
Right, so yeah, you guys would just leave the instruments feeding back.
Yeah,
you know, all the lights would go out except for the lights that were plugged in.
At one point on one song, and I'm not talking, we'd get all the guitars feeding back, and we'd leave, and only Mo would stay there. Then when Glenn would come back on the stage and grab his thing after long feedback, and then Mo would get off the drums and attack him, and he would hold up the guitar above his head and he'd go bang 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 bang. And people are just like, oh my God, they couldn't believe their eyes. You know, and the lights are going with all this. Like he's hitting on Glenn's strings and the lights are going with it, you know? And just like, man, how are we going to sell this in America? That was like John Peel's thing. You know, you're never going to be able to sell this in America, you know? He had to go to England. He thought England would really love it. And he was right. I mean, they absolutely did. You know, they loved it in Pandora's Box. I mean, they loved it.
Yeah, but they'd never seen anything like that before. People, you know, hadn't started doing that stuff with feedback yet.
You know, he also got us a gig at that blues club in Watts, you know. And I don't know, the other guys have got to remember that. Because I that was the one where I got totally embarrassed during the break. You know, when they had a topless dancer, this big kind of overweight, you know, young Thai lady, black lady. And with this black guy wearing leotards, and they're doing kind of a sexy dance. And I'm still in high school. And I got aroused. And now we got to go back on stage. And I was like, oh, man. you know, that age, you know. You're not going to will that down. You know, that blues club thing, that all black blues club in Watts, John was with us on that gig. He went with us. He was there for that gig. And we didn't play anything but pure hardcore blues. I mean, we just did only our blues stuff. Like on the Gold Star album, but no, I'm not talking or anything like that. Just the blues stuff.
Right. So yeah, Jimmy Reed and Howlin' Wolf and all that.
Yeah, we played blues stuff and just exactly the way it was supposed to be played, and weren't trying to be rock and roll about it or psychedelic or anything, you know. And they loved it. They absolutely were honored. I mean, they were honored and we were honored that they thought we were doing a good job, you know? John Peel was there for this whole thing. John Peel was right there, you know?
my baby cut the string.
So, yeah, from the Gold Star Sessions, that was the single. You Don't Have to Go, Who's Been Talking.
That was the stuff we played at the Blues Club, at this black club. That was the stuff, you know.
So what was the idea for the 45? Was that to sell at your shows, or was this something that you wanted to have ready for when you moved to England?
This is to go to England. I don't know who selected those two songs, but that was the band who selected those two songs. It turned out that I'm Not Talking was the only one that really blew people's minds in England. And that was the one that Nigel Thomas jumped on. And that was the one that he tried to reproduce or did reproduce in IBC, you know, that 2-minute version. And that was the thing that he sold us to Fontana, that one song, you know, because all of a sudden there's this new sound. And it wasn't in those other earlier things. You don't find it in any of the other recordings except in I'm Not Talking.
Yeah. Most of the stuff you did at Gold Star was pretty conventional blues,
than just totally conventional, unexceptional. But I'm Not Talking. It was a thing that they wanted to know about. Oh yeah, do that. You know,
that version you did at Gold Star. I mean, it's fantastic. Like, I think it's about 6 minutes long. Was that similar to what you did live? That arrangement.
Well, live, we did a lot longer than that. And others like
the feedback in the studio and
live, we would leave the stage. You know, live, we would leave the stage, get it all feeding back. We didn't do that in the studio. I think we were limited. You know.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't have come across.
No, it wouldn't have come across. You can't. You got to see the guys leave, you know, and you got to see that the music's still going. And the only guy who's up there is the drummer, you know. And the only time he stops is when, you know, he jumps out and attacks Glenn. We would attack Glenn, and that was like a big show. But he'd get back on the drums and start playing again, and we'd all get up there, and everybody, God, wow. Because the lights made it all visual, you know? It wasn't just an empty stage.
That's one thing I can do without.
Let's talk about the decision to relocate to London. That was John's suggestion. So how did that, you know, how quickly did that all come together?
Pretty fast, you know? You know, I swear to God, I was such a space cadet, you know, and I was so not taking things seriously in those days. Like, you know, there's this Vietnam draft coming up at my desk, and I'm like, oh, man, it's nothing to do with me. And I should have been taking it seriously, you know, I wasn't taking anything. Like they're getting this plan together to go to the UK, man, let's do it. Yeah, come on, man. The only thing that happened was I got to go wait for this draft notice, which is like a month, you know, from the time they wanted to leave. And so they went over by boat, as you know, and I came over by plane. And it wasn't like there would be any reason for them to be famous already, because there wasn't even a full band there yet. But they were like saying that we've got a record deal and we need you over here to do this, you know?
Right. We're going to get into all that with part two, but let's talk about that. You had a final farewell Riverside show. This is June 4th, 1966 at the High Hope Club. You know, tell us what you remember about that night.
I remember that I was with this guy, Ted Chapin, who later became a doctor. It must be Edward Chapin. So he and I were surfer friends. He had a sports car, a little sports car, like an MG. And he was kind of a rich kid, the guy that liked to hang around the band. And so he had gone taking me to San Bernardino, and we had gone to this house owned by a guy named Tony Trunco. He lived with his parents, you know. And he takes me in the garage, and they've got a curtain. They've got blankets hanging around, and they're sitting in the middle smoking some weed. And that's the first time I ever smoked weed, you know. And so we sat down with them and smoked some weed, and all of a sudden, I'm like, whoa. And then some time passed, and I realized we got to go to the gig. You know, we were in San Bernardino, so we drove to the gig, and I'm stoned, and we're late. And so when I remember coming into the club, they're already playing. The Misunderstood are on stage playing, just an instrumental, you know. And so I run in, and I'm just like stoked because it was like our farewell gig, and it was full of people, and everybody was. I was like just going to make my grand entrance, or I was like, you know. I was pretty freaked out, actually, because I was late. But, you know, it was like, it was going to be good to be there, you know. So I jump on stage, grab the microphone, and say, "Let's do I'm Not Talking." And they start the song, and Glenn breaks a string and shouts "fuck" into the microphone at the top of his lungs. That's what I remember, you know. And after that, we couldn't do anything wrong. After you break a string and shout "fuck," you can't do anything wrong, you know.
So that was a memorable show, your final show in Riverside.
Well, they loved it. Everybody loved it. I mean, they liked us already, but I mean, we're going to go to England. I mean, that's a crazy thing to be doing in those days.
Yeah.
Think about how many people have ever done it to this day since, you know?
And the other guys, they left the next day. They took all their equipment.
That night, after the gig, we all went to the airport, and they all took a plane to New York or somewhere. Where they went to get the boat, you know. I don't know. I forget where it was. It was in your book. It's in your article. They went to, where was it? New York. I thought they went
took
to
all,
New York.
They took all the equipment, too. All the equipment flew to New York and then a boat to England.
Yeah. So I came back with John Peel from the airport and went home, where I lived with my parents, and waiting for my draft physical, which was four or five weeks away, you know. In the meantime, they were getting stuff together and trying to get me to get over there. And I didn't want to be in America anyway, you know. And my mom and dad bought me the ticket to the one way ticket to UK. I didn't even know I was supposed to have a visa. I was so naive, you know. I get to England and I was like, "Hey man, where's the band?" And they're like, "Hey, this is the United Kingdom." You know, "Yeah, well, that's okay. Where's the band? Where's your visa? What's a visa?"
Let's get into that with part two next time.
Yeah.
We'll leave off this time with the band on their way to England and you waiting to do your physical for the draft.
Which is gnarly. When I went to do it, it was pretty scary. All of a sudden, it's like serious business.
You know, how was that, you know, that initial physical?
Well, it was a little bit shocking, you know, because being treated like cattle, you know, in a war machine that... Everybody's acting super serious, and you're not allowed to even laugh about it, you know? That was like, you know, pretty gnarly. I mean, I'm not even talking about boot camp. Boot camp was like, you know, they were so rude that it was beyond belief. It's like rude is like, I mean, it was so rude. And yet, when you think about it from a point of view, you're trying to make people into soldiers that commit murder. I mean, you know, you've got, how rude do you have to be? I mean, you know, they were making us chant "kill, kill, kill," which is just a one-word mantra. And the fact that human beings are doing that is just almost unbelievable. But it's, you know, I guess if you're going to make people into killers, you know, you got to make them chant "kill, kill, kill." But it was like so ridiculous because America was not under attack at all, you know?
And for you, yeah, that you must have really been torn because also, you know, your father was, you know, big in the military. You know, he was an Air Force officer, right?
Well, he was watching the news every day, and I could see all this fighting on the black and white TV, and or whatever it was. And my dad's like trying to tell me something about it, and I didn't want to hear about it. It's like if I'm trying to tell Jeeva something about what's going on in the world, he doesn't want to hear about it either, you know? Because you know, I see Jeeva, he's like, you know, whatever's going on, just let me know what the situation is now so I can adjust my work schedule accordingly, you know, because I don't care about, you know, what's coming up. I just let me know what's going on right now and I'll adjust my work schedule accordingly. I don't have a care about it one way or the other. I'll just have to adjust my work schedule, you know, pragmatic new kid, new generation, you know? Kind of, you know.
But back then, it was sort of the same for you. You didn't care about anything else.
Yeah, well, in a simpler way, I just, you know, I couldn't be bothered. It was like, this is old people's nonsense. Like, what in the world are you going to go to a jungle for and shoot these people 10,000 miles away? And I couldn't even comprehend what 10,000 miles was.
Right.
I mean, you're a kid, you're just so dumb. It's unbelievable. But it's good to be dumb like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were totally focused on your goal, which was... to make it with the band, to go to England and do something with the band. And all that other stuff was just extraneous distraction.
Well, if you're going to be distracted by all that other stuff, you're not going to end up being in a band. That's all. Because you're going to end up going to Canada or joining the National Guard or doing something. There was only one way out of it. Or even if you got in the National Guard, you're going to have to go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so, but you could have enrolled in college, that got a college deferment at that point, but
yeah,
that would have affected being in the band.
Yeah, no matter what you do, you know, besides just not paying attention to it, you're going to not be in the band. The only way to be in the band is to just ignore all that.
So that's what you did.
Yeah.
But none can hear my siding shred. I knock and yet remain unseen, for I'm dead. Yes, I am.
The Ugly Things podcast was produced by James Archer and hosted by Mike Stacks. That's me. In part two, next time, Rick Brown will talk about the band's adventures after their arrival in London, the groundbreaking music they recorded there, and how, at the moment of their breakthrough, their dreams were shattered. Ugly Things magazine is available at the very coolest record and bookstores and at uglythings.com. That's ugly-things.com, where you can also order back issues, vinyl, CDs and books, and read additional articles and reviews. Please subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and spread the word to your friends. We would also really appreciate it if you became a Patreon supporter. For just a small monthly donation, Patreon members get exclusive access to all kinds of interesting bonus content, including interview outtakes. Your contribution will help us to keep bringing you the very best in 1960s beat, garage, psychedelic music, and more. I'd like to send out a personal thank you to our top Patreon supporters: Glenn Sadin, Glenn Gibbs, Leon Jones, Charlie Koenigsacker, Keith Patterson, Sophia Swartz, Dean Curtis, David Biasotti, David Jones, Michael Barbera, Chip Lyon, Rob Brannigan, Stephen Schmidt, J. Paul Reiger, Derek Davidson, Craig Easton, and Phil Payne. Thank you, all of you, for your support. And thank you for listening.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.